The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft. Part 8. That night, Carter camped in a roadside meadow beneath a great ligath tree to which he tied his yak, and in the morning resumed his northward pilgrimage. At about 10 o'clock, he reached the small domed village of Urg, where traders rest and miners tell their tales, and paused in its taverns till noon. It is here that the great caravan road turns west towards Salarn, but Carter kept on north by the quarry road. All the afternoon he followed that rising road, which was somewhat narrower than the great highway, and which now led through a region with more rocks than tilled fields. And by evening, the low hills on his left had risen into sizable black cliffs, so that he knew he was close to the mining country. All the while, the great gaunt sides of the impassable mountains towered afar off at his right, and the farther he went, the worse tales he heard of them, from the scattered farmers and traders and drivers of lumbering onyx carts along the way. On the second night, he camped in the shadow of a large black crag, tethering his yak to a stake driven in the ground. He observed the greater phosphorescence of the clouds at this northerly point, and, more than once, thought he saw dark shapes outlined against them. And on the third morning he came in sight of the first onyx quarry, and greeted the men who there labored with picks and chisels. Before evening he had passed 11 quarries, the land being here given over altogether to onyx cliffs and boulders, with no vegetation at all, but only great rocky fragments scattered about a floor of black earth, with the gray impassable peaks always rising gaunt and sinister on his right. The third night he spent in a camp of quarrymen, whose flickering fires cast weird reflections on the polished cliffs to the west. And they sang many songs and told many tales, showing such strange knowledge of the olden days and the habits of gods, that Carter could see that they held many latent memories of their sires, the great ones. They asked him whither he went, and cautioned him not to go too far to the north. But he replied that he was seeking new cliffs of onyx, and would take no more risks than were common among prospectors. In the morning he bade them adieu, and rode on into the darkening north, where they had warned him he would find the feared and unvisited quarry whence hands older than men's hands had wrenched prodigious blocks. But he did not like it when, turning back to wave a last farewell, he thought he saw, approaching the camp, that squat and evasive old merchant with slanting eyes, whose conjectured traffic with Lang was the gossip of distant Dailath Lean. After two more quarries, the inhabited part of Inquanach seemed to end, and the road narrowed to a steeply rising yak path among forbidding black cliffs. Always on the right towered the gaunt and distant peaks, and as Carter climbed farther and farther into this untraversed realm, he found it grew darker and colder. Soon he perceived that there were no prints of feet or hooves on the black path beneath, and realized that he was indeed come into strange and deserted ways of elder time. Once in a while a raven would croak far overhead, and now and then a flapping behind some vast rock would make him think uncomfortably of the rumored Shantak bird. But in the main he was alone with his shaggy steed, and it troubled him to observe that this excellent yak became more and more reluctant to advance, and more disposed to snort affrightedly at any small noise along the route. The path now contracted between sable and glistening walls, and began to display an even greater steepness than before. It was a bad footing, and the yak often slipped on the stony fragments strewn thickly about. In 2 hours, Carter saw ahead a definite crest, beyond which was nothing but dull gray sky, and blessed the prospect of a level or downward course. To reach this crest, however, was no easy task, for the way had grown nearly perpendicular, and was perilous with loose black gravel and small stones. Eventually, Carter dismounted and led his dubious yak, pulling very hard when the animal balked or stumbled, and keeping his own footing as best he might. Then, suddenly, he came to the top and saw beyond, and gasped at what he saw. The path, indeed, led straight ahead and slightly down, with the same lines of high natural walls as before. But on the left hand, there opened out a monstrous space, vast acres in extent, whence some archaic power had riven and rent the native cliffs of onyx in the form of a giant's quarry. Far back into the solid precipice ran that cyclopean gouge, and deep within earth's bowels its lower delvings yawned. It was no quarry of man, and the concave sides were scarred with great squares, yards wide, which told of the size of the blocks once hewn by nameless hands and chisels. High over its jagged rim, huge ravens flapped and croaked, and vague whirrings in the unseen depths told of bats or ur-hags or less mentionable presences haunting the endless blackness. There Carter stood in the narrow way, amidst the twilight, with the rocky path sloping down before him. Tall onyx cliffs on his right that led on as far as he could see, and tall cliffs on the left chopped off just ahead to make that terrible and unearthly quarry. All at once the yak uttered a cry and burst from his control, leaping past him and darting on in a panic till it vanished down the narrow slope toward the north. Stones, kicked by its flying hoofs, fell over the brink of the quarry and lost themselves in the dark without any sound of striking bottom. But Carter ignored the perils of that scanty path as he raced breathlessly after the flying steed. Soon the left-behind cliffs resumed their course, making the way once more a narrow lane, and still the traveller leaped on after the yak, whose great wide prints told of its desperate flight. Once he thought he heard the hoof-beats of the frightened beasts, and doubled his speed from this encouragement. He was covering miles, and little by little the way was broadening in front, till he knew he must soon emerge on the cold and dreaded desert to the north. The gaunt gray flanks of the distant impassable peaks were again visible above the right-hand crags, and ahead were the rocks and boulders of an open space, which was clearly a foretaste of the dark and limitless plain. And once more those hoofbeats sounded in his ears, plainer than before, but this time giving terror instead of encouragement, because he realized they were not the frightened hoofbeats of his fleeing yak. The beats were ruthless and purposeful, and they were behind him. Carter's pursuit of the yak became now a flight from an unseen thing, for though he dared not glance over his shoulder, he felt that the presence behind him could be nothing wholesome or mentionable. His yak must have heard or felt it first, and he did not like to ask himself whether it had followed him from the haunts of men, or had floundered up out of that black quarry pit. Meanwhile the cliffs had been left behind, so that the oncoming night fell over a great waste of sand and spectral rocks, wherein all paths were lost. He could not see the hoof-prints of his yak, but always from behind him there came that detestable clopping, mingled now and then with what he fancied were titanic flappings and whirrings. That he was losing ground seemed unhappily clear to him, and he knew he was hopelessly lost in this broken and blasted desert of meaningless rocks and untraveled sands. Only those remote and impassable peaks on the right gave him any sense of direction. And even they were less clear as the gray twilight waned and the sickly phosphorescence of the clouds took its place. Then, dim and misty in the darkling north before him, he glimpsed a terrible thing. He had thought it for some moments a range of black mountains, but now he saw it was something more. The phosphorescence of the brooding clouds showed it plainly, and even silhouetted parts of it as vapors glowed behind. How distant it was he could not tell, but it must have been very far. It was thousands of feet high, stretching in a great concave arc from the gray impassable peaks to the unimagined westward spaces, and had once indeed been a ridge of mighty onyx hills. But now these hills were hills no more, for some hand greater than man's had touched them. Silently they squatted here atop the world, like wolves or ghouls, crowned with clouds and mists, and guarding the secrets of the north forever. All in a great half-circle they squatted, those dog-like mountains carven into monstrous watching statues, and their right hands were raised in menace against mankind. It was only the flickering light of the clouds that made their mitered double heads seem to move. But as Carter stumbled on, he saw arise from their shadowy caps great forms whose motions were no delusion. Winged and whirring, those forms grew larger each moment, and the traveler knew his stumbling was at an end. They were not any birds or bats known elsewhere on earth or in dreamland, for they were larger than elephants, and had heads like a horse's. Carter knew that they must be the Shantak birds of ill rumor, and wondered no more what evil guardians and nameless sentinels made men avoid the boreal rock desert. And as he stopped in final resignation, he dared at last to look behind him, where indeed was trotting the squat, slant-eyed trader of evil legend, grinning astride a lean yak, and leading on a noxious horde of leering Shantaks, to whose wings still clung the rime and nitre of the nether pits. Trapped though he was by fabulous and hippocephalic winged nightmares that pressed around in great unholy circles, Randolph Carter did not lose consciousness. Lofty and horrible, those titan gargoyles towered above him, while the slant-eyed merchant leapt down from his yak and stood grinning before the captive. Then the man motioned Carter to mount one of the repugnant Shantaks, helping him up as his judgment struggled with his loathing. It was hard work ascending, for the Shantak bird has scales instead of feathers, and those scales are very slippery. Once he was seated, the slant-eyed man hopped up behind him, leaving the lean yak to be led away northward toward the ring of carven mountains by one of the incredible bird colossi. There now followed a hideous whirl through frigid space, endlessly up and eastward toward the gaunt gray flanks of those impassable mountains beyond which Leng was said to be. Far above the clouds they flew, till at last there lay beneath them those fabled summits which the folk of Inquanok have never seen, and which lie always in high vortices of gleaming mist. Carter beheld them very plainly as they passed below, and saw upon their topmost peaks strange caves which made him think of those on Ngranek. But he did not question his captor about these things, when he noticed that both the man and the horse-headed Shantak appeared oddly fearful of them, hurrying past nervously and showing great tension until they were left far in the rear. The Shantak now flew lower, revealing beneath the canopy of cloud a gray, barren plain, whereon, at great distances, shone little feeble fires. As they descended, there appeared, at intervals, lone huts of granite and bleak stone villages, whose tiny windows glowed with pallid light. And there came, from those huts and villages, a shrill droning of pipes, and a nauseous rattle of crotala, which proved at once that Inquanok's people are right in their geographic rumors. For travelers have heard such sounds before, and know that they float only from the cold desert plateau which healthy folk never visit, that haunted place of evil and mystery, which is Leng. Around the feeble fires, dark forms were dancing, and Carter was curious as to what manner of beings they might be. For no healthy folk have ever been to Leng, and the place is known only by its fires and stone huts, as seen from afar. Very slowly and awkwardly did those forms leap, and with an insane twisting and bending, not good to behold, so that Carter did not wonder at the monstrous evil imputed to them by vague legend, or the fear in which all dreamland holds their abhorrent frozen plateau. As the Shantak flew lower, the repulsiveness of the dancers became tinged with a certain hellish familiarity, and the prisoner kept straining his eyes and racking his memory for clues to where he had seen such creatures before. They leapt as though they had hooves instead of feet, and seemed to wear a sort of wig or headpiece with small horns. Of other clothing they had none, but most of them were quite furry. Behind they had dwarfish tails, and when they glanced upward, he saw the excessive width of their mouths. Then he knew what they were, and that they did not wear any wigs or headpieces after all. For the cryptic folk of Leng were of one race with the uncomfortable merchants of the black galleys that traded rubies at Dailath Lean, those not quite human merchants who are the slaves of the monstrous moon things. They were indeed the same dark folk who had shanghaied Carter on the noisome galley so long ago, and whose kith he had seen driven in herds about the unclean wharves of that accursed lunar city, with the leaner ones toiling, and the fatter ones taken away in crates, for other needs of their polypus and amorphous masters. Now he saw where such ambiguous creatures came from, and shuddered at the thought that Leng must be known to these formless abominations from the moon. But the Shantak flew on, past the fires and the stone huts and the less-than-human dancers, and soared over sterile hills of gray granite and dim wastes of rock and ice and snow. Day came, and the phosphorescence of low clouds gave place to the misty twilight of that northern world. And still the vile bird winged meaningly through the cold and silence. At times the slant-eyed man talked with his steed in a hateful and guttural language, and the Shantak would answer with tittering tones that rasped like the scratching of ground glass. All this while the land was getting higher. And finally they came to a windswept tableland which seemed the very roof of a blasted and tenantless world. There, all alone in the hush and the dusk and the cold, rose the uncouth stones of a squat windowless building, around which a circle of crude monoliths stood. In all this arrangement there was nothing human, and Carter surmised from old tales that he was indeed come to that most dreadful and legendary of all places, the remote and prehistoric monastery wherein dwells uncompanioned the high priest not to be described, which wears a yellow silken mask over its face, and prays to the other gods and their crawling chaos, Nyarlathotep. The loathsome bird now settled to the ground, and the slant-eyed man hopped down and helped his captive alight. Of the purpose of his seizure, Carter now felt very sure. For clearly the slant-eyed merchant was an agent of the darker powers, eager to drag before his masters a mortal whose presumption had aimed at the finding of unknown Kadath, and the saying of a prayer before the faces of the great ones in their onyx castle. It seemed likely that this merchant had caused his former capture by the slaves of the moon things in Dailath-Lean, and that he now meant to do what the rescuing cats had baffled, taking the victim to some dread rendezvous with monstrous Nyarlathotep, and telling with what boldness the seeking of unknown Kadath had been tried. Leng and the cold waste north of Inquanach must be close to the other gods, and there the passes to Kadath are well guarded. The slant-eyed man was small, but the great hippocephalic bird was there to see he was obeyed. So Carter followed where he led, and passed within the circle of standing rocks, and into the low-arched doorway of that windowless stone monastery. There were no lights inside, but the evil merchant lit a small clay lamp, bearing morbid bas-reliefs, and prodded his prisoner on through mazes of narrow winding corridors. On the walls of the corridors were painted frightful scenes older than history, and in a style unknown to the archaeologists of Earth. After countless eons, their pigments were brilliant still, for the cold and dryness of hideous Leng keep alive many primal things. Carter saw them fleetingly in the rays of that dim and moving lamp, and shuddered at the tale they told. Through those archaic frescoes Leng's annals stalked, and the horned hooves and wide-mouthed almost humans danced evilly amidst forgotten cities. There were scenes of old wars, wherein Leng's almost humans fought with the bloated purple spiders of the neighboring vales. And there were scenes also of the coming of the black galleys from the moon, and of the submission of Leng's peoples to the polypus and amorphous blasphemies that hopped and floundered and wriggled out of them. Those slippery grayish-white blasphemies they worshipped as gods, nor ever complained when scores of their best and fatted males were taken away in the black galleys. The monstrous moon beasts made their camp on a jagged isle in the sea, and Carter could tell from the frescoes that this was none other than the lone, nameless rock he had seen when sailing to Inquanach, that gray, accursed rock which Inquanach's seamen shun, and from which vile howlings reverberate all through the night. And in those frescoes was shown the great seaport and capital of the almost humans, proud and pillared betwixt the cliffs and the basalt wharves, and wondrous with high fanes and carven places. Great gardens and columned streets led from the cliffs, and from each of the six sphinx-crowned gates to a vast central plaza. And in that plaza was a pair of winged colossal lions guarding the top of a subterranean staircase. Again and again were those huge winged lions shown, their mighty flanks of diorite glistening in the gray twilight of the day and the cloudy phosphorescence of the night. And as Carter stumbled past their frequent and repeated pictures, it came to him at last what indeed they were, and what city it was that the almost humans had ruled so anciently before the coming of the black galleys. There could be no mistake, for the legends of Dreamland are generous and profuse. Indubitably, that primal city was no less a place than storied Sarkomand, whose ruins had bleached for 1,000,000 years before the first true humans saw the light, and whose twin titan lions guard eternally the steps that lead down from Dreamland to the great abyss. Other views showed the gaunt gray peaks dividing Leng from Inquanok, and the monstrous Shantak birds that build nests on the ledges halfway up. And they showed likewise the curious caves near the very topmost pinnacles, and how even the boldest of the Shantaks fly screaming away from them. Carter had seen those caves when he passed over them, and had noticed their likeness to the caves on Ngronik. Now he knew that the likeness was more than a chance one, for in these pictures were shown their fearsome denizens, and those bat wings, curving horns, barbed tails, prehensile paws, and rubbery bodies were not strange to him. He had met those silent, flitting, and clutching creatures before, those mindless guardians of the great abyss, whom even the great ones fear, and who own not Nyarlathotep, but hoary Nodens as their lord. For they were the dreaded Night Gaunts, who never laugh or smile, because they have no faces, and who flop unendingly in the dark betwixt the Vale of Thnath and the passes to the outer world. The slant-eyed merchant had now prodded Carter into a great domed space whose walls were carved in shocking bas-reliefs, and whose center held a gaping circular pit surrounded by 6 malignly stained stone altars in a ring. There was no light in this vast, evil-smelling crypt, and the small lamp of the sinister merchant shone so feebly that one could grasp details only little by little. At the farther end was a high stone dais reached by 5 steps, and there, on a golden throne, sat a lumpish figure robed in yellow silk, figured with red, and having a yellow silken mask over its face. To this being, the slant-eyed man made certain signs with his hands, and the lurker in the dark replied by raising a disgustingly carven flute of ivory in silk-colored paws, and blowing certain loathsome sounds from beneath its flowing yellow mask. This colloquy went on for some time, and to Carter there was something sickeningly familiar in the sound of that flute, and the stench of the malodorous place. It made him think of a frightful red-litten city, and of the revolting procession that once filed through it. Of that, and of an awful climb through lunar countryside beyond, before the rescuing rush of Earth's friendly cats. He knew that the creature on the dais was, without doubt, the high priest not to be described, of which legend whispers such fiendish and abnormal possibilities. But he feared to think just what that abhorred high priest might be. Then the figured silk slipped a little from one of the grayish-white paws, and Carter knew what the noisome high priest was, and in that hideous second stark fear drove him to something his reason would never have dared to attempt, for in all his shaken consciousness there was room only for one frantic will to escape from what squatted on that golden throne. He knew that hopeless labyrinth of stone lay betwixt him and the cold tableland outside, and that even on that tableland the noxious Shantak still waited. Yet in spite of all this there was in his mind only the instant need to get away from that wriggling, silk-robed monstrosity. The slant-eyed man had set the curious lamp upon one of the high and wickedly stained altar-stones by the pit, and had moved forward somewhat to talk to the high priest with his hands. Carter, hitherto wholly passive, now gave that man a terrific push with all the wild strength of fear, so that the victim toppled at once into that gaping well which rumor holds to reach down to the hellish vaults of Zin, where gugs hunt ghasts in the dark. In almost the same second, he seized the lamp from the altar and darted out into the frescoed labyrinths, racing this way and that as chance determined, and trying not to think of the stealthy padding of shapeless paws on the stones behind him, or of the silent wrigglings and crawlings which must be going on back there in lightless corridors. After a few moments he regretted his thoughtless haste, and wished he had tried to follow backward the frescoes he had passed on the way in. True, they were so confused and duplicated that they could not have done him much good, but he wished none the less he had made the attempt. Those he now saw were even more horrible than those he had seen then, and he knew he was not in the corridors leading outside. In time, he became quite sure that he was not followed, and slackened his pace somewhat. But scarce had he breathed in half relief when a new peril beset him. His lamp was waning, and he would soon be in pitch blackness, with no means of sight or guidance. When the light was all gone, he groped slowly in the dark, and prayed to the Great Ones for such help as they might afford. At times he felt the stone floor sloping up or down, and once he stumbled over a step for which no reason seemed to exist. The farther he went, the damper it seemed to be, and when he was able to feel a junction or the mouth of a side passage, he always chose the way which sloped downward the least. He believed, though, that his general course was down, and the vault-like smell and incrustations on the greasy walls and floor alike warned him he was burrowing deep in Leng's unwholesome tableland. But there was not any warning of the thing which came at last. Only the thing itself, with its terror and shock and breathtaking chaos. One moment he was groping slowly over the slippery floor of an almost level place, and the next he was shooting dizzily downward in the dark through a burrow which must have been well nigh vertical. Of the length of that hideous sliding he could never be sure, but it seemed to take hours of delirious nausea and ecstatic frenzy. Then he realized he was still, with the phosphorescent clouds of a northern night shining sickly above him. All around were crumbling walls and broken columns, and the pavement on which he lay was pierced by straggling grass and wrenched asunder by frequent shrubs and roots. Behind him a basalt cliff rose topless and perpendicular, its dark side sculptured into repellent scenes, and pierced by an arched and carven entrance to the inner blacknesses out of which he had come. Ahead stretched double rows of pillars, and the fragments and pedestals of pillars that spoke of a broad and bygone street. And from the urns and basins along the way, he knew it had been a great street of gardens. Far off at its end, the pillars spread to mark a vast round plaza, and in that open circle there loomed, gigantic under the lurid night clouds, a pair of monstrous things. Huge winged lions of diorite they were, with blackness and shadow between them. Full 20 feet they reared their grotesque and unbroken heads, and snarled derisive on the ruins around them. And Carter knew right well what they must be, for legend tells of only one such twain. They were the changeless guardians of the great abyss, and these dark ruins were in truth primordial Sarcomand. End of part 8.